Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in the world. We explore many important aspects and areas of life, including business, sales, physical, mental, relationships, spiritual, disabilities, and many more interesting topics. Our broadcast team so far consists of outstanding people from both Canada and the U.S., including several Napoleon Hill certified instructors as well as authors. My name is Tom Tutall Cunningham, and I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I'm also a regular contributor to their weekly newsletter, and I spoke in March of this year, 2012, at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, who was the keynote speaker for the event. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 44 years now. And I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced and been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1". Sometimes I lie and say 5'2". That's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. Despite those physical challenges, I'm very well known for always answering amazing when asked how I am doing. I'm also a senior research director for the Canadian Business Journal, which is a digital-only publication, and we're the official and only media partner of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. You can find out more about me at my website. It's tom2tall.com, tom2tall.com. My guest today is Inez Blackburn. Inez is a globally recognized speaker and industry leader. She's an innovator and pioneer in launching global brands with over 25 years experience. She has worked with many Fortune 500 companies and led numerous executives through her position for profit seminars and marketing to the Max workshops. She has been on the Dean's List for Excellence in Teaching for 10 years and is a featured trainer at numerous executive events. Her first book, Pride, Passion, Profit, 7 Steps to Category Development, has sold over 5,000 copies and is well positioned to help companies take their category plans to the next level. Inez is currently the Director of Research at the Institute for Retail Innovation and Education at the Central Group, where I was lucky enough to have a plant tour yesterday. She's also an adjunct professor at the University of Toronto, Wright State University, and SP Jain University in Singapore and Dubai. Inez conducts both quantitative and qualitative research in a state-of-the-art research facility, an ROI lab, leveraging best-in-class technologies and research protocols. Prior to becoming addicted to research and an adjunct professor, Inez held numerous executive positions for numerous packaged good companies for national brands and private label. She was the vice president of marketing for Cott Corporation, where she was responsible for developing and launching private label brands for major retailers in Canada, the United States, and Europe. She has also held progressive positions at Nabisco, Robin Hood, Multifoods, Red Lobster Canada, and for those of you who remember, Consumers Distributing. She has also worked extensively with major corporations and has played a pivotal role in implementing customer-centric strategic plans, marketing to the max, retail trends and opportunities, demand planning best practices, the balanced scorecard, and teaching companies how to leverage the power of collaboration for a sustainable competitive advantage. The evolution of category management, category development, and activity-based costing are just a few of the customized training sessions she conducts. Inez is often featured at conferences around the world and conducts training seminars on category development, shopper marketing, product lifecycle management, supply chain strategy, and marketing according to the Art of War, Generation Text, and the Era of Postponement. Welcome to the show today, Inez.
Thank you.
That is a lot of things that you are doing. Pretty impressive, and it was so nice to meet you yesterday at the Central Group.
Thank you. My pleasure, and you always sound more important when someone else introduces you. So thank you for that.
Now, I found out yesterday, because this wasn't in our questions, but I found out yesterday you have read Think and Grow Rich. And so one of my first questions is always, about what age were you when you read that book? And was there someone important in your life that recommended it to you?
Actually, it was a few years ago, and it was when, you know, the recession first hit, and, you know, doing consulting and research became very difficult, you know, at the time. So I've always figured that you're defined by not what happens to you, but how you choose to react to it. And I'm a dedicated nerd, and I spend a lot of my time in bookstores and libraries, and I had heard about the book but never had the privilege of reading it. So about 5 or 6 years ago, I took it off the shelf, bought it, and actually read it, and it really changed my perspective on how you should view things and how you should really just commit yourself to a purpose, you know, your passion and a goal, and then just move towards it. So it was really the book that taught me how to treat my life as a GPS, that you just plug in the destination and just move towards it. And just like the GPS doesn't ask you where you've been or what you've done, I think that's the way that you should look, you know, at your life. Figure out where you want to go and then find a way to get there. And it was
exactly.
Very inspirational, yes, for me.
And that's the number one principle of Napoleon Hill is definiteness of purpose. And
yeah.
So hard for people to find that. Often they don't find it till later in life. And one sad statistic that I quote a fair bit is that 80% of kids who enter college and university are working in a totally different field within 5 years after leaving. And so what a benefit to yourself and to your profession that you were able to find your definite purpose early enough in life to pursue it with passion.
Yeah, I think that's very much true. But also, you know, the book had also taught me how to differentiate between who you are versus what you do, because I'm one of those people who had undergraduate degree in finance and economics and then went on to graduate level studies in finance. And I was the worst stockbroker on the planet because I'm not into the hard selling and telling people to buy things just based on a commission. So even after getting that grounding, realized that there's other things that were better suited to my skill and my passion for what I wanted to do. And I've always had an inquisitive mind. You know, I have 7 siblings. I'm always analyzing their next move. So research just seemed like a logical fit. And also marketing, because the industry and the environment's always changing. And for me, it was like if you don't have the right viewer perspective of any situation, your action will be flawed. And that's exactly the case in deploying a marketing strategy as well as a research protocol.
Exactly. And I was fascinated yesterday when I visited you at the Central Group and their ROI lab at how much consumers are studied and all the qualitative and quantitative research. It's almost like we don't have a chance when we go into a retail store because there's so much science based on displays and packaging and all the different things that are involved in a retail store. How do you see technology influencing shopping behavior in the future?
Well, I think there's 2 sides of that question. You know, one is that, you know, technology will change the shopper and consumer behavior, but the other side of it is that consumer behavior and the shopper will impact and influence technology. So it's always creating that perfect balance. What technology has done, I guess, in the last decade is enable the average shopper to have like a confluence of information at their fingertips at all time. So the level of involvement and getting information about products and brands is there. The other side of that coin is the amount of information can definitely influence the buyer because, you know, today I believe, and if you'd have to break this up by demographic, millennials versus baby boomers, you know, more and more there's a global consciousness on, you know, I don't want to buy a brand. I want to join a brand for what they stand for. I think that, you know, technology allows you to build a closer relationship, you know, with the shopper. Things like mobile marketing, social media, you know, just the fact the evolution of the computer to ThinkPads, it's always on, everywhere, all the time. So I think mm-hmm. technology is influencing behavior, but I think it's a tipping point. On the one hand, there's a bubble of technology. So just because social media is there doesn't mean I want to be social with every product I buy and every place that I buy it. And the reason why it's called social media is because it infers a relationship, and I really want to build the strongest relationships with the people that matter to me. So, for example, my family, my friends, you know, things along those lines. And I think that there's a tipping point for how much the average shopper or consumer is willing to put up with, because I don't want to get an email message from machines all day long about a product. It's you have to sort of stage it so that, time it. I want information when I'm in the store. I don't want the information when I'm at a social event, eating dinner, or somewhere else. The other side of it is that you can't have technology for technology's sake, per se. Technology should somehow make your life better, easier, happier. You know, and I think when you look at everything around you and people say technology is supposed to help, because of the influence and I guess the invasive influence of technology, workers actually work longer because they're always accessible. It's, you know, a lot of studies have been done on how the brain reacts to a text message and email. And, you know, you don't want to use an analogy to crack, but it's highly addictive. It's actually people in studies that, you know, the withdrawal symptoms of the brain, similar to drugs, will actually light up when you haven't received a text message or an email from someone that you've been waiting for in a sustained period of time. So, you know, when the kids get upset when you take away their phone, it's not a technology device. It's basically a connection to their world. And when you take that away, that connection is severed. So with all that said of technology, you know, it's such a generic statement. I think at the end of the day, are companies using technology in a way that helps them appreciate their consumers or their shoppers more? Is it being used in a way where they're making that shopper feel welcomed, you know, feeling that I'm happy that you came here, please come back? So I think there's two dimensions of it. I can use technology to communicate to a shopper, to convey a relevant message, but at the end of the day, the message doesn't make someone feel a certain way, it's the experience. So that's why when you came to the Central Group, it was so important, because I can't talk about the Central Group. You need to experience it. You need to see firsthand. You saw the passion of the designers and anyone you met, that they were so willing to talk to you and very excited about the work that they did. And, you know, the fact that a lot of people will say, well, these are just displays. Displays aren't created equally. We use technology to understand every aspect of that display, from a market research perspective, neuroscience, to the structure, to the design, to the supply chain, to everything. So at the end of the day, you can't be selective in the adoption of technology unless that technology has a definite purpose and positioning in the problem that you're solving with it, or the life that you're making better as a result of it. So it's kind of like in the dot-com era, that sooner or later the bubble bursts and you get a pushback. And I think that, you know, if I could buy an app today, it would be Don't Bug Me. So I can just invoke that and be left alone for an hour just to get that nirvana in a day. Because it's constant. You know, 80% of my emails are from a machine, and yet I'm most likely to read the ones from a person. So I think you've got to be really careful when and how you deploy technology. And that's one of the key things in the ROI lab, that we are always on the lookout for what's new and what's next, to say, you know, how is this technology going to affect the path to purchase? How is it going to affect you at shelf? How is it going to affect you, you know, with respect to your relationship with the shopping experience and with the brand? And I think more and more, we recently did a happiness survey and we asked people, you know, has technology and social media really made your life better? And the millennials responded by saying, well, no, because I don't like to be bugged by social media all the time from people that I don't know or companies.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing, a lot of them commented on the aspect that social media seems to be the primary purpose, you know, is being used for negative things like bullying. And so the younger generations, I mean, are opting out of certain sites or putting higher levels of control, because while you're social and you get information, it also, the other side of the coin, allows people to access you at an unparalleled rate never seen before in history. So, you know, so those are challenges.
So true. And I love to hear the terms marketing and ROI in the same sentence or in your case in that lab, because I think the marketing has evolved over the years, and I would think different executives have different opinions of the metrics of marketing departments in this day and age. You work a lot with the consumer packaged goods company. I would think that marketing is a lot about store awareness, getting people into the store, and then once they're in the store, probably influencing their buying behaviors towards obviously what would be, the primary profit center in their retail stores. Is that like true? Do you see that marketing departments are changing, their metrics are changing, and they're being viewed differently by C-level executives in these big companies?
Well, I think there's two sides of that one. You know, first of all, at the very basic level, you know, marketing is defined by creating products that the market needs and wants. And that's often a dichotomy in the sense that often what companies want to sell may not be perfectly aligned with what shoppers or consumers want to buy. And when you look at that, if you follow that model with research, you know, you see 40,000 items or more in a grocery store and this overwhelming of choice. So what's happening in the marketing realm is you see the evolution of different components of marketing evolving as a standalone department. So an example of that is you've got a traditional consumer marketing who understands, you know, the brand equity, the relationship that you have with the brand. But then you have shopper marketing and trade marketing departments that really talk to what is the relationship of a shopper to that brand in a retail store and how do you maximize that communication, that relationship. And then a third dimension is you can even have another department of online marketing. And, you know, the challenge that I see is any point of contact with a shopper, should be aggregated under one roof so you understand the whole relationship of that experience. Now, you also asked me about metrics. Technology goes hand in hand with being able to monitor the reaction a shopper has to shelf. So an example of that, you know, you've got Martin Lindstrom, who does MRI research, who will put an MRI cap on someone and look at the parts of the brain that get engaged when they're faced with a certain stimulus so they can see what the level of engagement or emotional connection is based on that. That's one area of research. At the universities, the University of Toronto and many universities in advertising effectiveness around the world, they will ask a respondent questions, what do you like and dislike? But what they're measuring is pupil dilation or brain activity. Another dimension of marketing, you know, you have virtual marketing environments, which is very different to our lab. And you can get a whole bunch of assumptions and research from that arena. The challenge that you face is a virtual environment. Often the shopper doesn't mirror and map the habitual behaviors of shelf. And for marketing, that's really, really critical in the sense in that path to purchase when you have that awareness and the interest about the brand, the desire to go and buy it from the media and then the action in the store. A virtual environment doesn't trigger the action like the retail space, and thus the importance of the ROI lab to actually test, does this marketing communication or this, you know, does it really work? Does our marketing at retail solution work? Whether it's animated ink, whether it's a shelf talker, whether it's a display, you really have to look at it in the context of the shopping, you know, environment. So with all that said, because of the access to information and the invasive potential of, you know, mobile marketing, you can actually monitor where people are in the store. There's research technology out there that the shopper can even tell you what they like and dislike and use their smartphone to do it and upload it. So
Wow. Before
you would just, and I'm going back, I'm dating myself and aging myself, but you go back 25 years, you would just run a promotion. You'd have advertising, you'd have an ad, you'd have a promotion in store, and you would look at what the volume lift was and said, that was successful because we sold so much more. Well, now you can do all that, but you have the ability to do research at many stages in that path, so you can check to see if the display is effective before it gets to store. You can actually test with store operations how easy it is to assemble before it gets to the store. Then you can look at how appealing it is in the context of the shopping environment, and you can make modifications because we have our research facility before it actually goes out to the retail environment. So when you're talking about marketing, it's changed. It's tougher because the levels of accountability are much higher. You know so much more. But at the end of the day, the shoppers haven't changed. They still want value. It's the price-value equation versus the price war. They still want to be appreciated. They still want products that are relevant. They still want things that make their life easier. And they want an environment that's inviting and fun to shop in, versus, complex and difficult. So I think for marketing, you can't just look at one aspect. You have to look at the whole path to purchase and say, what can we do at every point of contact to make sure that we appreciate this customer, they have a positive experience, and their associated memories to our brand become much higher as a result of everything we're doing versus just one piece. And I think market research before would be like you'd have a puzzle of 10 pieces and you'd take out a green piece and you could say, oh, this is the grass, when in actual fact it could be a car or it could be someone's shirt. Well, now you've got more pieces of the puzzle to put together to get the right view. So the action you take, I think, is much more effective and successful today than it was. I spent a lot of time guessing 20 years ago, which you don't have to do to the same degree. I mean, we didn't have cell phones back then, when you think about
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
A lot of
our shopping experience is subconscious. Some of the decisions we make, we talked yesterday, you have a Dove display at the ROI lab, and I was saying how for the last 6+ months, my wife has been buying the same box of green Dove soap, and yet on a retail shelf, there's probably like 25 different soaps that are on a shelf. And so you talked a little bit about the brand Dove, their symbol, and the connection they have with people before they even get to the store. And so that's all entailed in marketing, isn't it? Even people being aware of your brand and the feeling they get from that brand before they get to the store.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's really a discussion of how your brain works. So it's like when you walk into a store, this has been more pronounced, I guess, in the recession, where people have been trying to cling on to those emotional triggers that represent a happiness state throughout their lives. So at one point, you see when the more stress someone's under, the more that they need relief from that stress and the more they need to go back to a place and a time and an experience where they felt happy. And this actually came out in the research we did on the happiness index. So what that means is when you're in a store and you see a product, a brand, an image, a package, or even if you're influenced by scent or smell, any memory that's associated with that in your brain comes forward at the time that you see the trigger. So, for example, if you see an Oreo cookie and you've had a highly stressed day and you have a fond memory of that Oreo cookie, eating it, dipping it in milk, and eating it with your parents. If you see Dove and all the memories associated with their very effective marketing campaign and celebrating women and real women and what that means, those associated memories come forth when you're faced with the stimulus. So in terms of neuroscience, the challenge is making sure that when you're doing a display or a package redesign, that you understand what those associated memories are and you leverage brand cues at shelf to strengthen that relationship. So, and this is what I've seen over and over again. If you look in Canada, you get 10,000 new products launched a year, and I think it's 0.5% that sometimes make it to the second year. And the reason for that, it's the way the brain works. When you see a new product, you have to create a new memory. The brain has to do a lot more work to understand it and make sense of it. Whereas if you have a brand that's really strong, like Apple, like I would argue Apple's a cult versus a brand, you have associated memories with that. So when they come up with something new, you have a greater propensity to want to buy that because what that brand stands for versus a company that's starting up. Now, it's not to say you can't do that because there's a lot of very, very successful companies, but you really have to be right on the money with understanding how to engage the brain at emotional level because it's emotional and so it will override a rational decision. So, on that note, we did some research before where we had people, we had plates, and one was McDonald's with fries, a Diet Coke, and a salad, and another was a McDonald's Big Mac with fries and a Diet Coke. Now, the overall perception is the meal that included the salad was significantly less calories than the one that didn't have the salad. So So, which was fascinating to me because they associate salad with health, so therefore it's less calories. And logically that didn't make sense because you're eating more food.
Right.
You didn't replace anything. You know, so things like that, or we've had tests with ice cream where we picked a brand that was very popular for a demographic from when they were 12 to 16 or 9 to 16, let's say. And they've chosen the brand that was most closely correlated to a flavor that was familiar in that age group. But as we add information saying this is a healthier brand, this has natural vanilla, this has lower fat, the decision changed based on information instead of just the somatic marker of taste and the associated memories. So the question is, as you introduce information to the brain, you can actually change the perspective and pivot the shopper away from one decision to another. So, you know, before, you know, in marketing, you would just look at price, promotion, place. And now you're really looking at everything starts with the shopper. What's the shopper experience? What's the shopper expectation? You know, what's the shopper understanding? What are his attitudes and beliefs? What's important to them? How do we stay relevant in this sea of choice? The questions and the levels of accountability have gone through the ceiling on that note. You know, so when you're looking at, you know, neuroscience, we're just scratching the surface. But just the surface that we've scratched, if internalized, could significantly influence the status quo of marketing protocols today. And, you know, simple little things like, you know, the evolution of the human brain, they're conditioned to look more at human faces. They're conditioned to be less threatened by curves, because the human body's curved. You know, you're looking at the primal fears of the evolution of the human brain and saying, how do we take that knowledge and leverage it in the best practices for marketing at retail? That's the challenge. And that's one of the key things that we can do here at the ROI Lab. So when we develop something, we're making sure it's the best that we can do, especially since we have, you know, 30 designers on premise.
Yeah. And one thing that I was intrigued with yesterday that I hadn't even ever thought of, because we've just talked about retail customers and their behavior in the stores. However, consumer packaged good companies are working with the retailers when they put together these displays to make it lighter for shipping, put it together in one piece. The product is right inside the packaging. And so many of these things, when you consider large stores with many locations, the efficiency involved in these displays for the retail store, I had never even thought of that. But being from a management consultant background for 4 years, I learned about standardizing these processes and efficiencies. If you have 1,000 stores and you save 10 seconds every hour off of one task and you combine that by 1,000 stores, you've saved the company a ton of money. And that's not something I had even considered of. I always considered the displays are mostly focus or aim for the retail customer, but now you're also tailoring them for, in this instance, in the case where you're doing some things with Walmart, to make it efficient for their employees to put it up, to package it, to put it on display. And so tell me a little bit about that as well, because it's not something I'd considered.
Well, you know, when you're looking, you know, in terms of in-store marketing at retail, there's so many different components. But when you're actually designing anything, you really have to understand it from the context of not just how it gets set up in store, but how it's positioned on the shelf and how it seamlessly moves through the supply chain. So, you know, how is it unloaded from a truck? How is it loaded onto a truck? How does it align with the manufacturing process? And so we have in-house expertise on manufacturing as well. You know, so the thing is that to understand every point of contact, that this package has to go through multiple transitions. We have to understand as much as we can from the context, because retailers work on very limited margins, and the slightest savings in a labor component or an efficiency or productivity component can have significant effects, you know, on the bottom line. So from that perspective, you know, there's a difference if you have a retail ready pack that you just put one unit on the shelf versus having, you know, a stock clerk have to unload 15, 20, or whatever that is. And that's a huge thing, as well as having, you know, the ability to co-pack. So you've got, instead of having a display that manually has to be set up with multiple components, you know, having a one- or two-step approach with no components, that it's kind of like a transformer for display, for the best way of explaining it.
And it's kind of like that. And you were even talking one of the designers about the instructions on the packaging to make sure that people from various cultures who maybe not have English as a mother tongue can set these up efficiently. And some very fascinating stuff.
Well, I mean, it's even visual work instructions are logical, because when you see an image, your brain can make sense of that faster than it can the words. There's an interpretation of words that, you know, you see a letter, you have to associate back to what that letter is. Whereas if you see an image, it's even faster, not only for the setup, but to understand what that message is as well.
Hmm.
So that's the other side.
And for a consumer packaged goods company, they have to garner a favor with the retailer as much as the retail customer, because space on shelves is limited, and anything you can do to work with the retailer to save them money on, as you said, labor efficiencies of any kind is going to generate some favor on your end for the space allotment you get on shelves as well, I imagine.
I think that's true. I mean, I personally have a lot of battle scars from really not thinking through execution at store. You know, and it's very early in my career that, you know, you're in marketing. So, you know, the view that we had for the retail shelf and, you know, is the package too high to fit on it? You know, how quickly is it to set up the display? I can honestly say I didn't spend as much time as I should have at that particular stage in my career, because it wasn't really the focus. But now, you know, retailers have vendor scorecards for execution across the supply chain. So, you know, with respect to that, if you have a display or in-store marketing initiative that is too difficult to set up or the products don't fit, you have a high probability that the retailer won't set it up at all. And you have to think of how much money supported that promotion. It's probably supported by advertising, media, direct mail, email, print, and all those other things. But you should dedicate yourself with any marketing promotion to put your products in danger of getting purchased. And if you don't think those things through, many companies have missed that opportunity because they don't understand the context of the entire supply chain and what has to go correctly, what has to happen seamlessly to get those displays in store on time in the right location at the setup time that you have, because also stores have very defined reset times when you can change a shelf, when you can set things up. And you just can't shut down aisles in a Shoppers Drug Mart or Loblaws and say, oh, I'm sorry, you can't walk down here because we have to set up these displays. It's not going to happen. It will not disrupt
exactly.
The shopper. So I think that, you know, it's a wider scan of understanding. And it's to the point, too, that even when I teach marketing at the University of Toronto now, we dedicate chapters to execution at store level and the supply chain, which if I looked at my course 25 years ago, those sections of my marketing book were noticeably absent.
Wow. Now, you were mentioning millennials, and then I've heard of Gen X and Gen Y. And so when you consider a retail setting, you could have anyone, a customer anywhere from 16 to 96 coming in your store, and the marketing efforts aimed at those different areas of ages is much different. How I buy at 49 compared to how a 16-year-old buys is a lot different. And so tell me about how the emerging demographics will impact retail trends over the next 10 years.
Well, what's interesting, if you look forward to 2020 as an example, you know, I'm just waiting for the day when kids are born cable-ready that you just plug them in and their stomach is a screen, because, like, right now it's unbelievable how tech-savvy kids are, even at the age of 3. Now, but if we look forward to, say, the year 2020 as an example, what I see is that the generation called the Silent Generation will no longer exist, which means anyone who was alive during the First World War won't be here anymore. The GI generation, the Second World War, they're gone. In 2020, baby boomers born in 1943 will be at the twilight of their lifespan. So when you're going forward and you're looking at, you know, Generation X, which is the 61 to 81, and Generation Y, millennials, is 1982-2005. So when you're thinking, how old are they going to be in 2020? They'll be in their 40s with families. Now, this generation is unique. They grew up with technology. They understand technology. They're going to use it for their purchasing decisions. They have a greater propensity to adopt a product online, but they are ruthless in holding companies accountable for their behaviors and their decisions. So what that means for retail is that you have to really understand who is your target demographic, but you also have to understand when and how to grow up with your target demographic. You know, and I think one of the best examples of that is portion sizes and the number of seniors and single households where, you know, to get the best price, you have to buy 6 or 8 of something, even though there's only 1 or 2 of you. And the stores are designed mostly in accordance to package type versus a meal solution. And then
I found that when I was single a lot, too. I ended up throwing out a lot of food because it's sold and packaged for more than one person.
Yeah, and you don't save anything if you end up, you know, throwing it out. So really understanding you can't use, you know, what you did for years when the average family had 4 kids and now you've got 2 kids. So that's cut in half. And yet when you really look at grocery and the portion sizes, have they really changed that much? Meal kits and individual portions are really taking off because of the new structure of what a household represents today. But the other side of it is that companies really have to do, I think, a better job of growing up with their shopper. So if I have someone who's a millennial now, what do they need now? What's important to them? And what do I need to do to make sure they stay with me 20 years from now? So you see brands that, you know, shoppers are loyal to at one age, but if you take that shopper for granted, then you're going to go to another stage in their life and you're not going to be relevant anymore. So, I mean, growing up with the shopper is key. The other side is, you know, the baby boomer generation now. I mean, if you've had the good fortune of choosing your parents correctly and you stand to inherit a lot, the baby boomers of today stand to gain and, you know, really have the millennials have a positive impact on their lifestyle for a certain degree. But many baby boomers today are putting their own experience and their bucket list ahead of let's leave this for our kids.
Yes.
So that's changing. So in the sense that reverse mortgages, that's going to impact the next generation of millennials in terms of how they behave. So when you're looking at this from 10,000 feet, you think of who are my target shoppers now? What are their needs and wants going to be 10 years, 20 years from now? How are their behaviors going to change? If they're not cooking at home now, and I don't teach them how to do that, they won't be cooking at home when they have kids at home. They're going to be looking for solutions and kits and one-step approaches. I mean, we'll probably have refrigerators and stoves that talk to you and tell you how to make things anyway by then. Then if you're looking at baby boomers your age, really think about packaging. I mean, I saw a store in Florida, they have magnifying glasses attached to the shelves so people can actually read directions. So I think while people say they understand it, what do they really do to make the lives of those shoppers easier? And, I mean, a good example was we were doing in our happiness survey, we did focus a bit on seniors and asked if their needs were getting met. And they had many complaints about how their body shape had changed in the apparel industry and saying that, you know, I can't, my dexterity in my fingers is not as good. I want things that are easy to put on. I want jewelry that's magnetized. And there was a whole laundry list, and yet they're a very large buying population that's saying, I would love to buy these things, I just can't find it. Then you find, you know, the 50-year-old today was like the 30-year-old of 20 years ago. And I face this challenge being in that demographic that, you know, where do you shop to look stylish? I mean, there's some outfits that people try to sell me that I might as well have a sign that said, welcome to my midlife crisis. And there's other things that they try to sell me with a watering can on that my mother wouldn't wear who's 80 because she figures it would make her look old.
Exactly.
So I think,
and then you were talking about even like with rheumatoid arthritis, the classes I lead, women talk about what can they buy. They talked about these snap-on watches because they're easy to put on and take off. You know, sometimes buttons are hard to do. And so, you know, this is a market that retailers have to think about and plan for as well.
They do, but I think, you know, more than that, you know, my sister has rheumatoid arthritis too, and it's got definite challenges in terms of dexterity and being able, you know, to just function. But the other side of it is time. you know, when you have something with 20 buttons down the back that you can't reach, it wasn't like women only had these types of clothes because they were going to a function with their husband later. Our lifespans haven't really increased much, but the amount of stuff that we do every day has to. And I think every segment, whether it's food, whether it's apparel, whether it's shoes, whether it's automotive, really has to recognize that you know, you've got compressed cycles for how people make decisions. So the easier it is that you allow people to understand what you're about and to make those decisions, I think the better off we'll all be.
Exactly. And I see even with packaging, like one of the challenges I have with my hands and fingers is a lot of packaging is hard to get into. You need like scissors and, you know, you need a small toolkit to get into some of these things. And, you know, and I'm younger. You imagine someone 70, 80 with bad hands trying to get into some of these things that they purchased is quite annoying sometimes.
It is, and I think the protocols for packaging to prevent stealing can't go counter to the experience in using the product, you know. So, and that's another point that you bring up, in the sense that if you look at the path to purchase and all the moments of truth, you know, there's one missing one, which I believe is execution at store level, which we've talked about. But the other side is that how does the shopper feel when they're actually using the product? And, you know, you talked about packaging. Another dimension of that would be, let's, you know, the trend towards eliminating salt and making foods more nutritious. One side of me says I would like to buy those products. The other side that says, you know, and I know a lot of my peers are in this, if I buy that product and I serve it to my family and I don't look good and they don't like it, I won't buy it again. So I think
you
have to look at the whole context and the whole experience and every interaction with your brand or product or store that's going to influence the relationship that you're developing or compromising as a result. And it's, like, you know, you can have, I mean, you only need to look at telecom companies where you've got the cheapest phone. It's amazing how anxiety levels, if you put biofeedback capabilities on people when they talk about their cell phone companies, their heart rate automatically goes up and their blood pressure. It's quite funny.
Mine does. I'm not really happy with mine, but I'm stuck with them.
Yeah, and that's the point. You know, so as you're going forward and you're looking at all of these, really just, you know, step back and really think, hey, what is it that I'm trying to do? Like, what am I really selling? Am I selling this can of something? Or am I selling an opportunity for the person who buys this to spend time with their family? Am I selling this garment? Or am I selling an experience the way that this person's going to feel when they wear it? Or if they give this gift to someone else? And I think you have to really look at context. And, you know, that brings to the discussion, which you sort of talked about, was, you know, what about the future and, you know, how are people going to behave? Well, I call the generations that are there now the era of postponement, because this recession is different. It's not going to be like other ones where people just, the recession's over, I've got a job, I'm going to go back to my spending habits from before. That's not going to happen, because this is one of the few recessions that actually destroyed wealth. So it's not just disposable income, it's replenishing the wealth that was destroyed as a result of the recession, specifically in the United States. And I think that's what's going to be really, really different. And, you know, you only need to look at the media and the magazine and print to see that many companies have gone back to nostalgia and being authentic and standing for something and being relevant. Because people today want their purchase to stand for something. Because it's so easy to find out, does this can of tuna kill dolphins? Is this shirt made in a country that doesn't honor labor laws? So
exactly.
Emotions are going to override that. And so, you know, when I look back 20 years, I'm like, okay, price, promotion, place, that's great. And you really thought, we'll run these promotions, we're going to get that volume lift, we're going to hit our numbers. But what happens after? You've just shifted volume and you've compromised your brand equity because you've set the price value equation lower, and they remember the lowest price. And now you've got shoppers that sales don't matter anymore. If you can take any flyer to any store and have the price matched, I can go wherever I want and just have to dedicate myself to taking all the flyers with me.
Oh, I love that. My wife just discovered this with Walmart, and it saves her a lot of traveling time among stores. And I thought it was such a brilliant idea, price matching.
Yeah, but look at the other side. You know, when you have someone, and I've experienced this, whether it's a Walmart or a No Frills or one of the other, what happens when the person in front of you has six flyers and a transaction that takes 3 to 5 minutes now takes 22? What's the chance? shoppers aren't going to go back there. And what is it they're trying to accomplish? Because you're only attracting the shopper that normally shops somewhere else that just wants the same price for coming into your store because you have something else on sale. But where is that getting a relationship? Where is it getting loyalty? So, you know, my grandmother, who's actually Scandinavian, we had a lot of questions about war and it relates to price wars, and she used to say the only people that win wars are the ones that are alive at the end of it. And you see there's been a lot of casualties in retail for playing that game because they've lost sight of what else can we stand for, you know, that's going to really connect with our shoppers.
Right. Price will get a customer in, but it's not going to always add to your bottom line, being the lowest price provider.
Right. So think about changing that around to say, what is the shopper expectation? What's the shopper experience? You know, how do I make that shopper feel? How do I connect it in emotional? What's the shopper emotional IQ from dealing, you know, from having the privilege of buying my brand or from me having the privilege of selling it to them? I mean, it's almost like a relationship. You know, when a shopper comes into a store, you know, do you love them when they walk in and do you miss them when they leave? That's the question I think to ask retail today. And how do you know, what have you done to demonstrate that that shopper is in fact missed or that shopper is in fact appreciated or loved when they walk in? And there's very few retailers that do that. And, you know, you have to say, you look at the retail landscape, Whole Foods didn't participate in the recession. And they have a premium price product, but they stand for something.
Ah, yes. And, I hadn't thought of that. And yeah, they're still busy. They didn't participate in the recession, as you said. Now, is there some a recipe for success for marketing at retail? And what are some of the best practices that they should consider?
I mean, there's no one rule of thumb or, you know, state of nirvana for retail. But I think that there are rules that do work. So, you know, and I think it's consistency. So when, you know, in marketing, in order to be successful to launch any product or sustain the success of a product, you do have to create that awareness and interest and that desire to want your product in some type of action. But with that said, how do you integrate your entire marketing strategy so you understand the experience at every point of contact and you use technology to make that shopper's experience better? I think that's the challenge. And I think the other side of it is emotional branding, to really understand, how do you stand out in a sea of choice? So instead of, you know, the really new versus me too question, I say really stands out there. You know, so marketing has evolved. You can't use tactics from 30 years ago and expect to be successful today. And I would say the secret to success is, you know, crossing that chasm from the orthodox to the extraordinary. And there are extraordinary brands out there that stand for something. Tom Shoes was the first to say, for every shoe that I sell, I'm going to buy a pair of shoes or give a pair of shoes to a child in a third world country who needs shoes. That's extraordinary. But what happens?
Yeah, an amazing concept.
Right. But, you know, so with marketing, you really have to step back and say, you know, who are we as a brand? What do we stand for? What is the problem that we're solving for this shopper? And to take more of a solution-based approach. So instead of selling a can of something or part of an outfit or a component of something, what is this? What's the context of this? And how do we make sure that that shopper really understands that we care and we put the best effort into what we're doing so they can have the best experience? And, you know, the truth of it is that shoppers today, they'll forget what you said, they'll forget what you did, whether it's a product or brand or retail experience, but they won't forget how you made them feel. And that's how you connect at an emotional level. How did you make them feel? So when I buy this product, when I come to the store, I really feel that you're happy to see me. I really feel that you're going to dedicate yourself to making my experience positive from every aspect of my senses, from every point of connection. It's consistent and it's authentic. And I think that's the challenge today, that you go beyond price, promotion, and place. And you think, okay, when someone comes into my store and see my brand, do I get noticed? Do they like me? Do they remember me? How do they feel when they left? How do they feel when they use it, my products? You know, it's a relation. You're building a relationship, and every point of contact counts. And I think if you apply the rules of relationship to marketing and branding, I think you'll see more winners.
I think so, too. And you see a lot of the term relationship marketing these days, and that's what it really comes down to. I'm reading a book titled Unmarketing, and it said you're only as strong as your weakest contact with the customer, and that could be anywhere from replying to a social media post about your company to poor customer service by a retail worker, all different aspects. And you remember those, how they made you feel, and that's determines a lot of people's buying in this day and age, is how the product or company made them feel.
Right, and with social media, I neglected to say also that social media is a peer-to-peer network. It's literally an online focus group where many shoppers are more likely to trust the experience of a stranger who's credible than they are to trust a spokesperson. And we're seeing that more and more. And it's like where you're seeing, you know, the relevance of other people's experience. But with that said, you have companies that do that really well. So if you have a question, there's companies, like I saw this Dick's Sporting Goods in the States, that if you have a question about a specific sport in a mountain boot, you can actually ask someone who has a hobby of mountain climbing. Whereas,
wow.
You know, you see a lot in the, you know, in a lot of retail landscapes, it's a sales clerk that sells everything, but they don't have much information or knowledge about the product or service that they're selling other than the price and where you find it. So if we could just go to higher levels of understanding, like you think about it. Like you look at some stores where whether you're selling golf clubs or shoes or a blouse or fish, but the person selling the fish can tell you how to prepare it, where would you go? If the person selling you the golf club actually plays golf or the skates, actually knows how to skate and tie the laces, you know, my husband had this experience just recently. He wanted to buy rainwear, and he said, you know, which one would be the best product, which is waterproof? And the salesperson said, I don't know, I don't cycle, but that one's on sale. You know, so he left and went to Cycle Path or one of the others, where I can talk to someone who's passionate about cycling. It's just like the Central Group. You can talk to someone who's passionate about displays and marketing at retail. So they get it. You know, and
exactly.
I think that's the challenge. And that's, you know, the sales force is the biggest point of contact. Those are your ambassadors in the field. And how much knowledge, so everything goes into the display. What do you do to the store to make sure that they understand what you're about? The more they understand, the more they can talk about.
Exactly. So many things to consider. Sure does. So many things to consider that I would never have thought of before seeing you and going down to the ROI lab. Thank you so much for your time today. And as we could talk for hours, because this affects so much of our lives, being in a consumer society, and there's so much research and science behind it these days that most of us aren't even aware of, that goes into so much of the marketing. And so thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I learned a lot, and I'm sure a lot of our consumers, which is everybody who has some money in their pocket, has learned a lot as well.
Oh, my pleasure. And do call anytime, and thank you for inviting me to be your guest on your show.
Have an amazing day.
You too. Bye-bye.